This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. A recent study on the brains of football players showed all but one in the study had signs of the disease CTE. But ISU coach Brock Spack says that makes no difference to him.
And I'd be one of those guys, too. I would say, hey, I'd do this all over again, and I'd try to do it better because I love the sport and what it did for me.
The changing landscape as football copes with its concussion problem. John Norton talks with the coach about that and about this year's team. Congressman Rodney Davis stumps for tax reform. And Junius Rodriguez runs again for Congress against Republican incumbent Darren LaCour. And a GLT news update on the way. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from listener contributions to GLT, with additional support from Country Financial Representative Justin M. Boyd. Information at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Joining us today in studio is Junius Rodriguez, a Eureka College history professor, and announcing again his candidacy for Congress in the 18th Congressional District. The current office holder is Republican Representative Darren LaHood. This will be Rodriguez's second run. He lost 72% to 28% last time around. Sir, what about that margin do you think is susceptible to change? That's a pretty stark hill to climb.
I think that most would be willing to acknowledge that in the past year, we've seen the political landscape change in very many respects. I think the earth indeed has moved. And one of the things that I would like to say, reflecting upon my race last year, in politics, you don't win a ribbon for second place. There's no runner-up award. But I would like to remind folks that when I ran last year, I was a vacancy appointment, which means that I only came into the race during the final 6 months of the campaign. As a result of that, my campaign was one that was not funded all that well. In fact, I put in $25,000 of my own money into my campaign, partly because I believe that if you're going to be considered as a serious contender, you have to have skin in the game. The other thing is my campaign staff last time consisted of a grand total of four people. So when you consider a six-month campaign as a vacancy appointment, a limited amount of money to support the campaign, a limited staff, we ended up getting 97,000 votes. Now, let's put this in context. There's only a handful of people in the history of the 18th Congressional District that ever got that many votes as a Democratic candidate. 97,000 is one of those bellwether marks. The second consideration that I would make, I got as high as 39% in some counties. My strongest showing was in the Macomb area in McDonough County. And the third point that I'd like to make on this is in some counties, I got more votes than the Democratic candidate for president of the United States. And I did that as a vacancy appointment running a six-month campaign that was underfunded and with a limited staff. When I look back upon that and couple that with what I learned from last year's experience, I would say that my stock is rising. And by comparison, I think that in the race that we're looking forward to in 2018, the incumbent is going to have to run on the basis of accomplishments. We'll have to run a campaign based on what he has achieved. And I believe in many respects, if the last 6 months have been any kind of indicator, that we may see that his opportunities to run on achievement might well be a campaign that's flatlining.
The district, it runs from Quincy to Bloomington Normal. It's huge. And it's drawn by the Democrats as a safe seat for Republicans, so they could actually make the district that includes the Quad Cities, whom Sherry Bustos represents, a little more competitive for Democrats. So if it's a safe seat for Republicans, how will you crack that nut?
Well, the district was designed to be a safe seat, and not only for the 17th, but also for the 13th, because keep in mind they split part of McLean County, they split Springfield. So that made the 13th more competitive for Democrats. It also made the 17th more competitive. Anyone who looks at the 18th has to recognize that it is a center-right district. That doesn't necessarily mean that it's a solidly red district. I think that there's a lot of purple to this district. There are many folks who might well call themselves Republicans, who certainly do have moderate positions on a variety of issues where they might well be more independent-minded. My campaign is going to be one where I am running as a centrist Democrat. I'm a moderate. That's what I've been all my life. That's what I'm going to continue to be. I'm seeking Democratic votes, but the truth is, in order to win this race, I need the votes of independents. I need the votes of Republicans with a conscience who want to see things change. And I truly do believe that we're witnessing a different kind of political climate than we've ever seen before. In very many respects, I think people are questioning whether the institutions of government can function. And we've well seen that running on a campaign slogan, you know, whether that slogan is Make America Great or whether that slogan is Repeal and Replace, running on a slogan perhaps allows a candidate to win an election, but it doesn't necessarily provide a clear path of action towards governance. And I think the people want to see policies enacted that are going to serve the needs, serve the interests of those who feel for so long that they've been left behind.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. We're talking with Junius Rodriguez, a candidate for Congress in the 18th Congressional District, a Democrat who is going to try to run, if there are no other Democrats who announce, against Republican incumbent Darren LaHood. The Republicans have set aside health care for the moment and are pivoting toward tax reform. What do you think needs to happen in the first major overhaul of the tax code in 30 years?
Now, much of this really remains to be seen what's going to happen in the months ahead as the Congress moves on this in this new direction. I believe that some of the fundamental changes that we need to see are tax reform that will benefit the middle class. For far too long now, we've seen the middle class has been nickel and dimed to death in many respects, that too much of the burden has shifted our way, in particular in the last four decades. This goes back to the origins of the whole trickle-down economics concept. At the same time...
Do you subscribe to that orthodoxy, by the way?
No, I don't. And I think that many Republicans today have come to recognize that that's a failed idea. If you look at the state of Kansas, Governor Sam Brownback in Kansas tried to make his state operate completely on the basis of trickle-down. And recently, the legislature there overrode his veto on several tax increases, and it's proof that the system failed in Kansas. In addition, legislatures in Tennessee and South Carolina have done similar things, and this is just in the past few months. I think one of the things that happens here is we see candidates run for office making promises they're unable to deliver. And you know, I'm a historian by training. One of the things that we do, we can't really write history in the immediate present. We have to wait and see what happens over the course of a generation. And in so many respects, we're always looking for evidence. The evidence is in. You know, we pretty much know now that the systems that were put in place in the 1980s, and let's be honest here, the system that both parties, that Republicans and Democrats have both come to own, is a system that has lent support to the wealthy, lent support to corporate interests. And one of the sad things that has come out of this, if you look at the entire process of campaign funding, especially as it's been defined since 2010 with Citizens United, we have seen that corporate interests, special interests, have taken a predominant position of influence in American government. Lobbyists are writing legislation. They're writing bills that are going to serve their own interest. Now, I know your early question had to do with tax reform, and I want to get back to that point. One of the things that we need to do is we also need to see tax reform with respect to the American business community, both for small business and larger business. In order to address this point, though, I think it's important for us to remember that the purpose of the IRS, the purpose of the Internal Revenue System, is to provide revenue. We, for far too long now, have taken the IRS code and we have dumped all sorts of other things into it. We have created different kinds of social programs and such that we have just sort of parked in the area of tax, saying that individuals would receive special benefits, that they would receive tax tax release on certain points. It's gotten to the point where we don't exactly know what the cost, what the real cost of all of this is. One of the things that we need to do is simplify our tax system. I would imagine that the people who would be most opposed to my ideas on tax reform are those folks who are corporate tax attorneys. Because if you stop and think about it, so much of what business and industry invest in this particular area is how can they cheat the system? How can they benefit themselves and try to avoid taxes? I think we need to simplify our tax code, create rates that are lower, but at the same time, we need to realize that revenue is going to be the most important. And so let's create a system where there's transparency, where we know that everyone's paying their fair share, where the idea of being able to hide taxes and, you know, offshore subsidiaries and other things, that this becomes something of the past, but it's not the system that we operate on going forward. I think if we do this, we can see economic enhancement across the board. And one of the things that I think comes out of this, you know, many people would say when it comes to provision of services, there's a limited pie. We can only cut it so many ways. We need to do things that are going to enhance the pie, enhance the system, you know, create more opportunities so that we can provide greater services.
One of the Republican ideas is to reduce the tax on investments. They say there is a savings crisis in the United States that doesn't allow the middle class to really save enough for retirement. What is your thought about that?
It's really rather interesting when you stop and think about it. And I'm assuming here you're talking about reduction in capital gains.
Mm-hmm.
A reduction in capital gains would certainly benefit those individuals who are part of the investor class, but that's not necessarily going to be the kind of benefit that the middle class really is banking on. If you think back to just about 8 years ago when United States Congress made the decision that we had to save the large banks because the banks were too big to fail. At that point, one of the things the middle class lost was that beautiful concept that we've always known and loved, the idea of compound interest, that if you put money into a savings account that you could earn money along the way. 18-year-olds at high school graduations always heard the speech about pay yourself first, put 10% aside throughout your life, and you're going to have this nest egg by the time that you graduate. Well, you see, that's been taken away. Those benefits or those things that could have provided opportunities for the middle class to save and to encourage savings, those things have been taken away. We have seen the protection of those institutions that are too big to fail. What I would ask of our elected officials today, think about the middle class as a corporation. That's right. We're the middle class incorporated. Yeah. Aren't we too big to fail?
You're going to need to unpack that assertion, I think, about taking away the incentive for moderate and middle-income folks to save. What do you mean by they've lost that compound interest?
Well, in so many of the accounts that banks now offer don't provide the same kinds of benefits that we would have seen just 8 years prior. That there was a greater opportunity where if you put money away that you could have a greater return on that.
So the financial products are just not there anymore.
Precisely.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. We're talking with Junius Rodriguez, announcing his candidacy for Congress in the 18th Congressional District, stretching from McLean to Adams County over by Quincy in the Mississippi River. You had talked about the effectiveness of the institutions of government. In a closely divided nation politically, those institutions are by necessity less effective because the opposition is more evenly matched on both sides. What can change this?
In very many respects, gerrymandering across the board, the way that we define our districts, and again, this is done at the state legislature level, We have politicians that are drawing districts, and they are choosing who their voters are going to be. This has helped to create the situation where on both sides, on the left and the right, we see increasing polarization occurring. I think one of the sad things...
In Illinois, this has benefited Democrats largely.
It works both ways. It works both ways. There are some districts that are heavily Democratic, but there are some that are going to be heavily Republican.
Too many safe seats, too little incentive to compromise.
True.
Because you're playing to the ideologues in your own party.
True. I do believe...
So why not run for a state office instead of a federal office and get that nonpartisan commission form of districting on the ballot or pass at a state level?
In a strange way, I think the question comes down to which is more dysfunctional, Springfield or Washington, and where do you think that the greatest impact can be
felt? A fine debate could be had on that.
Yes, yes. I do believe that change can occur at the federal level. And one of the ways to get to that point is, who does a representative represent? Who does a representative speak on behalf of? I think that in many respects, we have seen a system that has created a political class that speaks only for the interests of special interests, the moneyed class, the corporate class, the donors. The average citizen across the board, in many respects, feels disenfranchised by that process. I also believe that all too often we try to apply an ideological label to everything, assuming that that is the be-all, end-all of the American political process. But the truth of the matter is, if you look at a family in this district that is struggling through a personal crisis today because they have a child who is addicted because of the opioid epidemic, that's not an ideological kind of issue. That's a personal family crisis, and there are folks that are looking for help and looking for relief in some fashion. If you look at individuals who are struggling to find a job or folks who are worried about whether their pension is going to be safe as they approach their retirement years, these are not ideological kinds of questions. They're the real bread and butter issues. And I've always believed that anyone who seeks office, if they've never been the kind of person who has to sit around a kitchen table, look at a bill and say, how in the world are we going to pay for this? If they've never had to deal with those real-life kinds of issues, I think they find themselves disconnected from the realities of so many families across this district.
So you've mentioned, we've talked a little bit about tax codes. What other policies are you going to advocate in your campaign to address the failing middle class and to address those social ills that you just mentioned, opioids or the health care?
Job creation has to be one of the key things that any member of Congress is working toward in these days. I think the recent stat on this is that 6 out of every 10 jobs that is created through small businesses. It's not large manufacturing interests that we need to bring in, but we need to foster the development of small businesses. Now, coupled with that is to make sure that we are providing access to quality educational opportunity for folks that are both starting out in their careers, but also for those individuals who are at mid-career and who are having to retool and reinvent themselves in the new economy that we face. Healthcare has been, obviously, in the past 6 months, it's been the primary issue that we've seen debated at the national level, and that debate has certainly trickled down to what we've seen on the streets here in this district. One of the things that we must consider is that the legislation that was put forward, certainly by the House and then later the two bills that were considered by the Senate, did not really speak very much to health care itself. It spoke to relief for insurance companies. The House bill was going to provide a lot of tax relief to wealthy folk. One of the things that we've got to recognize is that there has been a sea change in terms of how the healthcare community wants to provide healthcare in the 21st century. We used to operate on a system that was basically a payment for service.
Fee for service. Now it's a wellness and preventive emphasis, although
right.
That is of necessity. It must be a hybrid of those two mindsets, because you still do need to get paid for what you actually do.
True. But the healthcare community itself does not want to go back to the old way of doing business. The healthcare community is actually willing to go down this path, this new path of trying to provide a system that can provide greater wellness, and at the same time, hopefully over the course of time, see a reduction in
cost. So what are you advocating? Are you advocating single payer? Are you advocating fixes to the Affordable Care Act that will reduce the overhead caused by insurance companies, and how do you stabilize the marketplace?
I think that there has to be a discussion, a full discussion that will be done through hearings in which everything is on the table. And I think a discussion of single payer is part of that. I do believe that if we've had problems with some counties being able to have enough providers, enough insurance providers, that having a public option available would be one of the things that we must consider as we look forward to the remedies. There's a great book on the topic of healthcare that just came out. Dr. Ezekiel Emanuel published a book called Prescriptions for the Future.
Rahm Emanuel's brother.
Okay. And in his book, one of the things that he talks about are 12 policies that could be developed in the healthcare industry that can move it forward. Now, here's the problem. When we see legislators talking about the issue of healthcare, they're not really talking about what can we do to benefit the healthcare system. They're not talking about how can we help to make improvements, remedy the system, make sure that prescription costs are going down. What they're doing is they're basically just sort of kicking the tires on the system that's in place. We need to make sure that there's a vibrant discussion where all voices are heard, and that's voices on the left and the right. Let's find out what the policy prescriptions are that need to be put in place. Let's find out what would be the cost of those, what's the long-range cost if we fail to act, and let's find a pragmatic solution that can move us forward. You know, if you would ask the typical American on the street, where do we fall in terms of healthcare? Some would say, well, you know, we've got the best system in the world. Wrong. We've got the most expensive system in the world. If you look at most metrics comparing us to other nations of the world, we come in at about 37th. I think Luxembourg is just a little bit higher than where we are in terms of the most efficient delivery of healthcare and best kind of delivery system.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Our guest today is Junius Rodriguez, a Democrat for Congress in the 18th District. You have said in your campaign literature that you want, as part of the boost of the economy and the support of the middle class, to engage in infrastructure rebuilding. There has been little success over the last 15 years in determining how to pay for that. What is your solution on paying for a big infrastructure and transportation bill?
One of the things that that I believe needs to be a part of this, and former Congressman, former Transportation Secretary Ray LaHood has been supportive of this for quite some time, is the idea that the federal gas tax has not changed in, I believe, the last 24 years. And as a result of that, what we see is the amount of federal monies that have been dedicated specifically to just keeping up, maintaining the current system, has had less and less buying power over the course of time in terms of what can be done. I think there's a variety of things that that we can consider in this regard. In some areas and with some types of improvements, there does exist a possibility perhaps of public-private partnerships that can actually assist with some kinds of infrastructure enhancements.
Typically thought of as a Republican idea. But
and that, you know, I'm willing to go along with some of those. I do believe that we need to consider infrastructure to be one of those things that can be the moonshot of our generation. And what I mean by that is there have been moments in our country's history where we've recognized that a true investment that not only develops the nation in a particular regard, but a kind of development that is going to have all sorts of ancillary benefits that come off of that, this is one of the things that we must seriously consider. If you've traveled and seen airports around the world and seen highway systems around the world, you recognize that we have fallen woefully behind in so many regards with respect to infrastructure. So if we're talking about the importance of economic development in the United States, one of the key things that one of the starting points for this is to make sure that we have an infrastructure that's going to be truly preparing us to compete in the 21st century. This also is one of those few areas where I believe that you can find agreement by both Republicans and Democrats in terms of the necessity. The way forward, again, is going to come to the nitty-gritty of how do we find the exact means of paying.
Let's continue along that thread then. You've mentioned the gas tax, which has eroded in buying power. You mentioned public-private partnerships. Another idea out there is a tax on electric vehicles or non-petroleum-based vehicles. What other revenue sources need to go into the portfolio to accomplish this?
If you recall earlier, we were talking about tax reform. And one of the things that I suggested at that time is the pie itself needs to expand. We need to see a greater amount of greater access to revenue resources that we can use. I truly do believe that and I can't give you an exact percentage here, but I believe that a significant percentage of new monies that we can accumulate as a result of tax reform. And this comes from both parts, the idea of middle-class tax reform and also the tax reforms for business, that a significant portion of that should be specifically dedicated to supporting a massive infrastructure campaign. We're looking at something that's maybe going to be a 10-year or longer campaign, but it's essential.
Junius Rodriguez is announcing his candidacy in events around the district for Congress in the 18th District. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
I'm Charlie Schlenker.
Support for GLT's Sound Ideas comes from Justin M. Boyd, Country Financial Representative. Building relationships while supporting and serving the community, Justin offers life insurance options designed to protect your family and leave a lasting legacy. Information at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Still to come, an interview with Illinois State University football coach Brock Spack. The Wall Street Journal reports that the administration tax plan would result in people in the $100,000 to $300,000 income range paying more in income taxes. Speaking to reporters at Vicky and Tim Tilton's business, Fox and Hounds in Bloomington, Congressman Rodney Davis, a Republican from Taylorville, addressed the question whether he thinks that's okay.
Well, take a look at our plan. We want to reduce rates for every single American in all of our brackets, reduce them down to a much more manageable level that's going to save middle-class families an average, we believe, of $5,200 for taxes that they would not have to send to Washington. They'd be able to put in their pocket, invest in college for their kids, invest in savings, invest in a home and in our communities.
So you're already departing from the administration plan?
Oh, the administration has their ideas, and what we're doing this month is we're putting out our ideas in the House. Our ideas are not going to match up with the administration completely at all, but what we want to do is throw out what we think is the best plan.
Democrats are hoping that any tax reform bill will go through regular order and not reconciliation. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, the same Democrats who are serving in the Senate and in Congress who use reconciliation to give us one of the most punitive laws that are stopping businesses from growing beyond 50 employees, among other things, are the ones that say they don't want to use budget reconciliation process. My ask of the Democrats in Congress then is to come to the table. We've used the Ways and Means Committee and many different committees of jurisdiction to help develop this plan. They were involved in those debates. They were involved in those discussions. They could have come and sat next to me and my friend Keith Ellison, who was sitting right next to me when we put forth some proposals to the Ways and Means Committee to think about during tax reform. So when you hear the other side complain about a lack of transparency, remind them they were there. They were there to help develop it. And now we are releasing this plan before it's in bill form to be able to get input from citizens throughout every district in the country, just like we're doing today, so we can take that information back and write a better bill with everyone's input. Don't fall for the false pretenses that people aren't getting involved. It's up to legislators to get involved in the debate, and it's time they did too.
Should it be revenue neutral?
Well, that's the best plan of action. But remember, when we go through this debate, every plan that's taken away or every proposal that's put back in is going to have a cause and an effect and a cost included in that. My main goal is to take the advice I got from the many individuals that were meeting with us in Springfield, is to go bold. You know, let's make sure we put a plan in place that's going to get bipartisan support, that's also going to grow our economy. And when we grow our economy and we see that economic growth, that's when you're going to see revenue continue to come in to the federal treasury, because I don't believe taxation and tax policy is a zero-sum game. And there are plenty of examples of that even outside of tax policy.
Is this a potentially easier lift than health care changes were?
I wouldn't necessarily say that at all. I think tax reform is going to be a very difficult lift, which is why it's so important that we started this tax reform tour today, meeting with people like Vicky to talk about the impact of any changes to the tax code to their ability to continue to be a viable small business in communities like Bloomington Normal.
Under health care, you had a situation where one part of the Republican Party wanted something very different from another part of the Republican Party. On taxes, isn't there more unity among the GOP?
Well, there certainly wasn't more unity among the GOP or the Democrats the last time a tax reform plan came out about 3 years ago. So we've already seen tax reform plans come out and be immediately disposed of by both parties. That's why we're reaching out now. We're on the front end trying to get input before we introduce a final bill, because we want to hear what Americans want when it comes to tax reform. Because frankly, they've told me since I've been running for this office that we need to make a fairer, flatter, simpler tax code. And now's my chance to take our ideas to them, get their input, and be able to write a better bill. This is a plan that would simplify the entire tax code, and obviously closing different corporate loopholes would be a priority. We want to lower the tax rate that American companies have to pay right now that make them less competitive with our neighbors like Canada and countries like Ireland. You know, every campaign year you see ads that say that so-and-so supports policies that create jobs overseas, that take American jobs away. Well, when I got to Congress, I asked what that provision was, and I was told that's the overall tax rate that American corporations have to pay in comparison to our competitors in the global marketplace. Well, the solution is to make America's tax code more competitive so that American companies will invest here rather than in Canada, Ireland, and other places.
As you pointed out, not all tweaks or changes are equal. Some tax wonks tend to say that expensing everything rather than cutting corporate rates is the way to go. Some wonks say the direct opposite. How do you feel about that, and who should be generally preferred? Should it be a small to medium-sized business like Fox and Hounds, or a larger business?
Our goal is to protect the middle class with tax reform, and the majority of benefits for tax reform would go to middle-class families and small businesses. That's our goal. We believe that's what our plan is. And if anyone wants to talk about the details of expensing versus deductions versus tax rates, now's the time. That's why I'm here. That's why we're listening to those suggestions, so we can take those suggestions back. And they've already been debated within the Ways and Means Committee, within those of us who have taken advantage of listening sessions and open mic discussions with the Ways and Means Committee, our tax writing committee, and it's been done on a bipartisan basis. You know, we've thrown our ideas out. Now's the time to hear more ideas and then take those ideas into consideration, not just in Washington, but in Middle America and Central Illinois.
What are a couple of ideas that you have heard already on the tour that find favor in your ears that you will advocate for in the final draft or final bill?
Sure. It's to make the tax code and the ability to prepare taxes much more simple. We were just upstairs talking with Vicky and her crew, and they want simplification. 75% of all Americans don't itemize. We want to raise that up to about 90 to 95% and still allow them to deduct for charitable expenses, home mortgage interest, and college expenses. These are three deductions that ought to be available on that same postcard, and that's our goal. That's part of our original plan that we're proposing right now, and we're hearing that from the people that we talked to today. We've also heard, Charlie, that they want us to go bold. They want us to actually have real, true tax reform that can grow our economy. And the last time we had economic growth that was substantial, 3% and above, we were able to balance the budget. Remember, the CBO projected during the Clinton administration in 1997 that we would have deficits for the next 10 years. And then seemingly overnight, we had the Balanced Budget Agreement of 1997. And what that did was it added to the economic growth. We balanced our budget. And now we need to do that and begin to make sure that we pay down the national debt.
The downside of simplification is that it has the potential to create artificial hard limits. If you fall above this line, you pay more. If you fall below this line, you pay less. And that there aren't enough lines to really have a fair gradation among the different categories of business that need help. How do you avoid this?
Well, I think when you look at the individual brackets, Charlie, you remember you pay up to a certain amount of what you make at a certain level, and then anything above that's a higher level. Anything above that, if you get to the third level, just that income above those other levels are taxed at that rate. And our goal is simplification, to make sure that we lower the rates for everyone. And lowering the corporate rate is going to have a substantial positive effect on companies like Fox and House, and to be able to allow them to invest more money back into our communities and invest more money like they already have into upgrading their facilities so that their customers can come in and get a better experience. The more punitive the American tax code is to people like Vicky right here, the less they can offer to their customers right here in Bloomington Normal. And Vicky, you got anything to add?
Yeah, Vicky, what is your situation? What do you want in tax reform?
We've had a really wonderful conversation. First of all, I want to see something happen. We find it very, very awkward and difficult to grow our business when we aren't sure where we stand a lot of times with the number of employees and so forth. We're very excited about something really happening. You know, your mention of how long this has gone on, of people talking about it, we think it needs to happen. And we can't take our business to Canada or to Ireland. We need to grow our business right here, and everything needs to be more friendly for the small business owners. And we're excited about these opportunities.
Would you respond to Democrats' assertions that dropping the tax rate on investments will disproportionately benefit the wealthy and not help the overall economy?
Any incentive that Washington can give to any American, regardless of what your definition of wealthy is, to encourage savings, I think should be encouraged. I mean, we have a savings problem in this country. We need to make sure we give every single American, regardless of your income level, an opportunity to take advantage of saving money for a rainy day, saving money to send your kids to college, saving money on something that families, when we were growing up, Charlie, took for granted, taking a vacation every year. That doesn't happen as much. So we've got to be able to do what we can to use the tax code that's going to allow families to put more money back into their pockets. And any policymaker, I don't care if you're a Democrat or a Republican, that says it's only going to incentivize somebody who makes more, well, if we incentivize people who don't make more and at the same time incentivize those who do to invest in their communities even more, to donate to charities, then I say good.
Republican Congressman Rodney Davis of Taylorville represents the 13th District of Illinois. He spoke to reporters during a tour of Fox and Hounds in downtown Bloomington. We also heard from business owner Vicky Tilton. Numerous Democrats have already announced exploratory committees or intentions to run in the Democratic primary next year in hopes of gaining the slot to run against Congressman Davis.
Support for GLT comes from Jack Batal Real Estate Group at Keller Williams. Jack and his team are committed to helping Bloomington Normal continue to thrive by giving back to GLT and other local nonprofits. Current listings at jacksguarantee.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Illinois State University football coach Brock Speck says he would make the choice to play football again, even had he known about the disturbing link between football and brain damage when he began playing. GLT's John Norton spoke with Speck on the Hancock Stadium turf about the recent concussion report that showed ex-NFL and college players who donated their brains after death exhibited a nearly 100% rate of the brain disease CTE. In the face of that, Speck maintains more good than bad comes from football. The coach also addresses recruiting and his excitement about the potential of this year's team, which returns talented quarterback Jake Colby.
I think the players we're going to put on the field are talented guys. I think they just lack experience for the most part. So there's only one way to get experience, that's you have to play. And, Jake was kind of in that boat himself a year ago. So I think he understands that. I think, if your skill players can make up for that sometimes. But there's really no way to learn it under fire. And we try to give him 1,000 reps in practice, as much, repetition as we can to get them ready. But there's nothing like game reps. So they're a talented group, but they just lack experience. So Jake, I think Jake's been through it, and Jake's a really good kid, and is a very good leader. And I think he'll be a good sounding board for those guys and a good person to watch and emulate how he handles his business as a college football player. So that should help those guys.
I'm guessing as any college coach. But you've been ranked, ISU football has been ranked somewhere between 2, 3, and 5 in the preseason in the Missouri Valley. Do you pay attention to that at all?
Not really. It's nice for, when you're ranked really high and your players, especially like when our players get preseason recognition, but it all kind of goes away when the ball is kicked off in September for real. Now you got to go earn it on the field. So that's what kind of makes our sport kind of cool, because it's talked about probably more than any other sport in America or in the world. It's just it's a talking point because the game has got so many moving parts in it. And so from that standpoint, I'm glad they talk about us. But the most important thing is how you perform.
Do you want to come in those preseason polls? You want to come in high, or do you want to come in a little bit lower to give the players some motivation?
I think you want to come in a little lower.
Do you? Really?
Yeah, I think that's – at least I like coming in there lower. I don't know what the players like, but I like coming in lower because it gives me a little cannon fodder for the football team, and, it gives you a little motivation and that we got a lot to work for yet.
I want to ask you a couple of questions about recruiting in general. Obviously, you're recruiting high school kids pretty strongly. I would imagine some junior college kids as well. But it seems a bigger part of the mix more and more has been some of the kids dropping down from the FBS level as well. Are you seeing more of that? And do you, as a coach, have to factor that into your mix when you're recruiting players now?
Oh, you definitely have to factor it in. I think the graduate transfers, the four-year school transfers are – and guys, like you said, are dropping down. We've made some very good moves that way, in my opinion, in the past. Trey Roberson was a kid that was a great player at Indiana, and for whatever reason was sharing playing time. He didn't want to do that. He wanted to be kind of give the opportunity to be the guy, and he came here, and it took us to a national championship. We've had a lot of other players. Nate Palmer was drafted and still playing in the NFL. He was a transfer from Illinois last year. We had B.J. Bello. This year we have some guys coming in, Josh Barajas is from Notre Dame. That's always going to be a part of, the equation. Now, why are they transferring? That's kind of that's what you want to find out. Is it the right reasons, or is there some baggage there that you really don't want to work with? It's how much, if there is baggage, what is it? Is it something you work with? And so you really talk a lot to their, former high school, their high school coaches, the former college coaches, people that recruited them at the college before, where they're at. And a lot of the guys I like to get are guys that we recruited that went bigger and we know a lot about, but they decide to drop by, so we know more about them. So those guys seem to be a little bit better.
Is this something that you target, so those kids, or do you find out about those kids, or how does that work?
Well, when a guy tells us no and moves on to a bigger opportunity, or bigger in his eyes, we always keep an eye on them. We always keep that door open. We don't want to burn bridges because you never know when they're going to come back to you.
Dan Verdon of ChicagoNow.com put out an article real recently about how ESPN3 especially has been a help for schools like ISU, the FCS schools, that in the past really didn't get much on television at all. And now Illinois State is one of the schools that you can see play football on TV quite a bit. How much has playing on television helped Illinois State?
Well, I think it's helped a lot, and we've played in big games. There's a saying in football, everybody remembers the games in November, and when you're playing for something in November, either conference championships or playoff bursts, that's that's really important. That's, and we've done that for a few years here now, maybe 5-6 years in a row.
Do you see kids actually talking about Illinois State where in the past they might not have because they've seen you on television?
Yeah, particularly in our state, you know, you can tell that the vibe's a lot different when I walk into a high school now compared to it was, you know, 9 years ago when I first came here. You know, they equate us to a real good football program. You know, you guys win. You know, you guys been a national championship.
You mentioned you've been here 9 years now. That was not here 9 years ago when you showed up. I'm pointing at the brand new stands on the Main Street side. How much of an impact has renovating Hancock Stadium had on your recruiting?
It's had a lot of impact. You know, when you walk in here now, and even if you're just a student that wants to go to school here, it's kind of the gateway to the university when you come off of, you know, 55 or 39, you come down Main Street from the north, you know, it's kind of the gateway to the university. And it's a very pretty building. It's well designed. It's architecturally eye appealing. It fits into the architecture here. And it's kind of a really nice way to start your visit here if you're an incoming student or a football player. But I think it helps all of our sports. You know, the winter sports and spring sports recruit during the fall. So their recruits come to our football games. And so they want to see a packed stadium, you know, a lively crowd, you know, a really cool environment. And this place has been an awesome place to play. And we've had a very good record here. And our fans do a great job. And so everybody's kind of benefited here, I think, from Illinois State, from the new stadium.
We're talking with Illinois State University football coach Brock Spak. It's media day. We're on the field at Hancock Stadium. And there was another devastating report that came out last week that showed how the longer guys played football, the better chance they had acquiring the brain disease CTE. And it is somewhat skewed because it was just from players who had died and had their brains donated, so everybody wasn't getting tested. Understanding that, this latest one, what does this study say to you?
Well, I just read an article online because that is a sensitive subject, and you have to. I think the rewards outweigh the risks in playing football. And the why I say that is, there was a brain specialist, I guess you'd call her. She put a big article out up in Chicago, and her son plays high school football, and why parents should let their kids play football. You know, she mentioned the statistic, like you said, but she kind of turned it around. Like, well, you're only, what you brought up, we're only looking at those who were obviously affected negatively by football. I don't think you're going to get anybody who plays the sport of football to say, hey, there's, you know, when we play this game, it takes a little bit away from us, you know, in our lives. You know, it's, you know, our lives shortened, maybe, probably. But if you ask, I would say, I don't know how many percentage would be, but a lot of guys would come back and say, hey, it was worth it, and I'd do it again. And I'd be one of those guys, too, who would say, hey, I'd do this all over again, and I'd try to do it better because I love the sport and what it did for me. So, you know, she was pointing out all the things that are positive about football and not necessarily the CTE. You know, there's a lot of other sports that have a higher concussion rate than football. And
boxing probably.
You would assume, but boxing doesn't have as much CTE than maybe you expect. But I would say there's injury rates. You look at say women's gymnastics. The injury rates for catastrophic injuries are way up over what football is.
How much has it changed the way you coach the kids on the field?
You know, from how we handle our preseason now, you know, we don't do two-a-days anymore. We go every other day in pads and no pads.
Is that a direct reflection for the concussion reports that are out?
Well, I think we're finding out that more is not better. And I think, if I'm not a doctor, so I'm a bad person probably to be quoted on this because I'm not an expert, obviously, but I am a football coach, and I've talked to neurologists, and you know, the brain will heal itself. When you get into problems is when a kid or a player isn't diagnosed, and all of a sudden he goes right back out and starts banging around, and he might bang his head again. Well, that's when the real damage happens. You know, a brain injury, for the most part, it can heal. You know, if you let it heal, you know, the concussion can heal. But you got, we're finding out, hey, we got to put this guy on the shelf for a while, let him get his bearings back. And what we do here after that, even after that, we go even longer than what the protocol is. But there's a protocol we all follow, and we must follow when it comes, at least a week. And then when after a week, we'll condition them pretty hard for a couple of days just to see if there's any type of reaction. And sometimes the players think that's a punishment for missing practice, and that's not the case. What we're trying to do is we're trying to find out, we want to physically exert you before we put you in and all of a sudden have contact again. So we're finding out that, you know, and then we're changing techniques. And we're teaching rugby-style tackling. I'm a defensive coach by trade.
Okay.
And where the head's not involved at all, a shoulder tackling. And I've noticed in the last 2 years since we went to that style of tackling ourselves, the helmet to helmet contact has been very little, very few big clashes of the head.
Illinois State University football coach Brock Spack talking with GLT's John Norton at Hancock Stadium during Media Day. ISU's opening game this year is Saturday, September 2nd, when they host the Butler Bulldogs. Thanks to John Norton and Laura Kennedy for today's show on WGLT Normal, a service of Illinois State University. You can hear their stories and interviews at WGLT.org. Our website is also where you can find the full Sound Ideas podcast. Let us know what you think of this show by emailing news@WGLT.org or share your thoughts at facebook.com/WGLTFM. We're all at WGLT News.